You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Episode number 37 of That One Time on Tour is brought to you by Punk with a Camera. Punk with a Camera, also known as Brandon Walsh, delivers a visual experience to modern DIY punk, showcasing bands from anywhere and everywhere who share the same punk spirit in both live performance sessions and directed videos. You can find the bulk of his work on youtube.com/punkwithacamera. Or if you want to get more involved, find him on patreon.com. You can also find Punk with a Camera on Facebook and Instagram at Punk with a Camera.
This is Anthony Boza, and you are listening to That One Time on Tour.
Bowie, Dylan, Marley. You've heard the names and maybe you've heard their songs, but what about the stories behind the records that made titans of music like these so universally loved and important? Join me, Josh Adam Myers, host of The 500, as each week I go through a different album from Rolling Stone Magazine's 500 Greatest Albums list from 2012 with an incredible lineup of comedians, actors, and musicians talking about how the music has impacted their lives. New episodes of The 500 come out every Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, what's up, guys and girls? This is Chris Swinney, your host of That One Time on Tour. This is where I sit down with someone in or around the music industry, and we have a stellar conversation. This week is no different. This is episode number 37, and I get to sit down and have a chat with Mr. Anthony Boza. Anthony is an author. He has done books with Slash from Guns N' Roses. He's done a book with Tommy Lee of Motley Crue. He did Eminem's first like biography type book. He's working on a book right now with Eminem. He did a book with Mick Fleetwood. The guy's been around. He used to work at Rolling Stone. I mean, he's got some amazing stories. And we talk about all of that here today on the podcast. And before I get to that, I want to take care of a little bit of business. Like I do every time I tell you guys about my amazing sponsors. Rockabilia.com is still on as a sponsor. They've been sponsoring this show since back like episode 10. So I want to give a shout out to Frankie and everybody at Rockabilia.com. They're an amazing company. You guys need to check them out. They have everything you've ever wanted from all of your favorite bands. Over 500,000 items in their store. It's insane. I remember when I was young and I'd get like, you know, Hit Parade or Magazine or Circus Magazine, and they had the little Rockabilia thing in there, and you would send off and you'd order these really cool shirts. Well, now it's easier because you can just go to their website, and they're getting ready to put out a brand new website too. So you need to go to Rockabilia.com and at checkout, put in the promo code PCTOTOT. That is our promo code, and they'll know that I sent you. And you get 15% off your order. So go check that out, rockabilia.com. Muncie Music Center is another sponsor that I tell you guys about every week. It's a store here in Muncie, Indiana that I actually work at. I teach guitar and anything with strings. If you are local, you need to go to 600 South Mulberry Street. And if you are not local, you need to go to MuncieMusic.com. They're an amazing store, so go over and support them. Shout outs to Dave and Blake and Scott and everybody at Muncie Music Center. Sticker Wolf is still on as a sponsor. They did the logo for the show. They've done stickers for the show. So, you know, thank you so much. They're a great place. You guys need to check them out at stickerwolf.com or on all the social media outlets. It is at stickerwolf. Last but not least, I'm going to tell you about Your Button Guy. Your Button Guy has done so many cool things for the show. He's done two different designs of buttons. He's done magnets for the show. If you need magnets or buttons done, like, you know, DIY old school punk rock buttons, go over to Instagram or any of the socials. It's Your Button Guy. And if you want to hit him up about prices or whatnot, hit him up. yourbuttonguy@gmail.com. So after you check out our amazing sponsors, go on over to patreon.com if you want to get more involved with our show and you'd like to help us out. It does, you know, there are costs that are incurred with, you know, hosting the the files and whatnot and equipment. So if you enjoy what I'm doing and you think you want to help out, go over to patreon.com/TOTOT podcast and become a patron. For as little as $5 a month, you can become a patron and help us out. And all the money goes to basically just keeping the show going. So check that out. And I would really, really appreciate it. If you can't, you know, if you're not in a financial place to where $5 a month, you know, you can't swing that. Biggest thing to help the show is to go to wherever you listen to podcasts and write a review, rate it, and subscribe. That helps the show grow, especially on iTunes. We're at 91 reviews right now, and I'm toying with this idea. At 100 reviews, I'm going to give away a huge prize. So go on over to iTunes if you haven't already and leave us a review, preferably a 5-star rating. You know, say how much you like the show. Don't tear me down. I'm not a professional, as you can tell. But go over to iTunes and leave us a review, and you could win some cool stuff. When we hit 100 reviews, I'm gonna give something away. I'll tell you what that is when we get closer to 100. But so thank you guys so much for listening. It's really, really cold. Here in Indiana, we have a foot of snow. We're supposed to get like another foot of snow this weekend. So, it's winter. It's January in the Midwest, man. What can I say? I was on the phone with a buddy of mine today out in California, and he's like, oh, it's raining. And I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah. You don't have a foot of snow on the ground. So thank you guys for listening. Make sure that you are following us on all of the social media platforms. It is at TOTOT podcast. We're posting some really cool stuff over on our Instagram. So go over there. That's where I hang out most of the time. But I'm also on Facebook and we do stuff on Twitter. But Instagram seems to be the place to be for podcasts. So if you're on Instagram, and I mean in this day and age, who isn't on Instagram, go on over there at TOTOT podcast. So now I think I am going to actually read a review. KBix is the one that left this review. It's a 5-star review. It says, the best part about this podcast is that Chris listens to his guests. It's not just question after question, it's a conversation. Chris knows the people and the business of music, so his topics are insightful, unique, and interesting. And because he offers discussion, his guests are comfortable and open with him. This is a must listen if you enjoy hearing the inner workings of the music industry and the best rock bands in the biz. Well, thank you very much, KBix. I really appreciate that. If you want to have your review read on the show as well, just go to iTunes and leave us a review. And I might, you know, I might read it on the show. And KBix, and then last week I read V Rob. If you guys want, you know, like a little sticker grab bag, hit me up at TOTOTpodcast@gmail.com and I will send you guys some free swag. So if I read your review on the show, I'm going to send you some cool stuff. Speaking of my email, TOTOTpodcast@gmail.com, if you want to become a sponsor of the show, hit me up and we'll figure it out. I'm looking for bands right now. I have a couple lined up for the next couple episodes. But if you guys want to be a sponsor on the podcast, go ahead and hit me up and we will figure it out. I think I'm about done with everything. Once again, like I always say, it's about 1:30 in the morning. I'm doing this. I just got my son to sleep a few hours ago and I've been doing some, you know, busy work on the podcast. Now I'm recording my intro. So thank you guys for coming along on this journey with me. We're going to get right into my conversation with Mr. Anthony Boza. I think you guys are really going to enjoy this. Anthony had some crazy stories. So without further ado, here it is, my conversation with Anthony Boza. And I'm on the line with Anthony Boza. How you doing today, man?
Good, Chris. How are you?
I'm doing great. I appreciate you being on the show. You're my first author.
Really?
Yeah.
Dude.
I usually talk to a lot of, you know, smelly punk rock musicians, but now I've got an author. I'm excited.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I might, you know, I'm oftentimes smelly, so at least I have that in common. But listen, you're starting at the top, dude. At least you're starting with, like, you know,
yeah,
the best author.
I'm starting with the best author. I've read a couple of your books and I'm a big fan, I gotta say.
Good. I'm glad. Which ones did you read?
I read part of the Tommy Lee book and I've read the Slash book.
Nice.
So and I really, really enjoyed those, and I'm sure we'll talk about those later on in the podcast.
Awesome.
But the one thing that I want to kick it off with, and I always do this, and I know that, you know, you're around musicians quite a bit. I know that music had to be a big part of your life. What was your first musical memory and what made you passionate about music?
It's a good question. My parents were definitely into music. So first sort of musical memory is probably, you know, my dad yeah, my dad actually, when he was a teenager, was in like a doo-wop group in the 50s. And he was one of the dudes who sang the high parts. So he had this kind of, it got annoying as I got older, but he had this tendency to always sing like the high parts or make them up in the car.
So he would like harmonize with the radio.
He'd harmonize, but he was like putting falsetto in there when maybe it wasn't there.
Yeah.
Cause that's he was good at it. He could sing that stuff. Sort of like Frankie Valli style. But, so I think my earliest memory is like him singing too high to songs on the radio. that was that. And then, you know, I grew up on Long Island, so you have to basically like have a Billy Joel album in your house or else they evict you. So I think the first song I really got into on their collection was like, You May Be Right.
Okay.
I think it was the Motorcycle Sounds and stuff, you know, I was pretty young. So that was like, that was the record I you know, kind of dove into as a kid. And then the thing that really turned me around was when I heard Debbie Harry singing Heart of Glass.
Oh, yeah.
And then I was like, what is that? And then I was like, girls are cool.
Girls are cool, man. Yeah.
Yeah. That sort of changed everything for me. I like heard that and heard, you know, the crazy kind of like the production and everything. And that sort of bugged me out. And I totally just got into like dove through like everything in their record collection and stuff like that. So
growing up on Long Island, did you go into the city much and maybe go to like shows when you were in like high school?
Oh yeah, totally. I lived close enough to a train that I could basically, when I was crafty enough and old enough, I was able to tell my parents that I was going to the library. And my friends and I at first we just take the train into like Penn Station and just even like play video games and drink tall boys because they would sell them to anybody. Yeah. But and after that, you know, I would kind of do the same thing and go to shows. Definitely, for sure. I went to a lot of stuff at the Ritz, which is Webster Hall now.
Okay.
That was one of my main spots. I saw like all kinds of crap there.
Did you spend any time at the Crazy Donkey there in Long Island?
No, I did not.
that was the last place that I played with the Ataris. It was back in like 2010 or something at the Crazy Donkey. I just remember that was a cool name for a venue.
A freaking awesome name. I'm like angry that I didn't go there.
I don't know if it was like a place that had been there for a while or if it was just like a pop-up place, but yeah, it was called the Crazy Donkey. I don't know if it's still there or not. I guess I could Google it, but I don't have the option right now. So
yeah, the podcast would get boring pretty
quick. The podcast would get super boring if I was Googling everything.
Let's just Google the entire list of shows ever played at the Crazy Donkey and talk about that.
So you loved music. It was a big part of your life. You ended up interning at Rolling Stone in 1995, I saw when I was doing some research. What led to that? And I mean, was it kind of your passion to do journalism at the beginning?
I went to college, but not for journalism. And it's funny, I went to Northwestern University, which has the very renowned school of journalism, and I didn't go. After college, wasn't sure what I was going to do, and some, you know, extenuating family circumstances that were out of my control kind of brought me back here sooner than I wanted to come back, but it all worked out for the best because, you know, I was like living at home and really just wanted to be in the city. And I, you know, started like, I started bartending and lived with an older cousin of mine and just sent out my resume to Rolling Stone and to a bunch of magazines. The other one, I got an internship the same day at Paper Magazine,
okay,
which is, you know, I think cooler. back then it was, cause it was like downtown and, you know, it still is. But, I got an internship at both places on the same day. And mostly because I had actually sent my resume in too late to get into the magazine section of Rolling Stone. But, I was going to be accepted for the next sort of, round of interns, which would have been, I don't know, like 4 or 5 months later. But when Kurt Cobain killed himself, the Rolling Stone had a books division back then still, and they needed to get a book done really fast. So they basically took all the interns that were approved for the magazine. And that was a kind of a cooler internship because I was like working on, you know, it was like be a regular sort of magazine intern or work on a Kurt Cobain book. And I was like, I'll do that. So
were you doing like editing and stuff? What were you doing for the book?
No, not at all. I mean, really, you know, I was an intern, so it was just like gathering every single mention an article that had been written on him in Rolling Stone for writers that were going to write these big essays about him.
Oh, God.
But I was pretty good at research because I was a history major, and the two editors of the book department, they gave me like more responsibility in terms of just helping the writers, and that was pretty cool. I was sort of like an assistant to the writers working on it, and I helped like do photo clearances and stuff like that. And then they sort of kept me on, and I worked on the Rolling Stone Encyclopedia of Rock and Roll, which they were going to do their second edition. And they kept me on it. They weren't paying me, so I got a job at a bar and then still did that a couple of days a week just because I loved it. And that actually started involving interviews because like the Rolling Stone Encyclopedia was – it's really thorough. And – you know, there were tons of people that were, they were sort of, you know, all these writers were updating these entries, and they had some pretty obscure artists in there. And when nobody had any idea how to sort of get in touch with them, it was my job to figure that out. So, and like call record companies and call publicists or, you know, find a manager.
Stuff and that would have been a way easier with the internet, right?
Oh my God. Yeah. This was like 96 at this point.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was brutal. There was LexisNexis, which still exists. And that was like the only writer thing. And I guess, you know, to make a long story longer, but I did all that stuff. And then I was basically, there was, you know, Rolling Stone, had its own library. I'm not sure if they still do, if everything's digitized now, but there was a librarian and I was in there so much that she actually got, you know, got it approved for her to have an assistant, and she hired me because I was like the research guy.
That's awesome.
That's how it happened. And then I just sort of stuck it out and, you know, was like, I'm going to work in the music department.
I read on the internet that you actually championed Eminem to them before he was even signed or even a thing. What was that all about? Where did you hear about Eminem? And can you like take me down that road? How you ended up talking to Rolling Stone about him?
Sure. Well, I was by then, you know, I stuck it out as a research assistant in the library, and then I worked a lot for all the music writers and got myself on the short list to be hired to be the music editor's assistant when someone who had been there for I think like 8 years, she was moving on. Not you know, she didn't die. She was not moving on in that way. She was moving on to another job. So I was the assistant there, and I had a friend who lived in LA and was really into, you know, sort of backpacker hip hop, and like so was I, like all the Ruckus Records stuff and just that kind of, you know, style of hip hop we were both really into. And he taped Eminem freestyling on the Wake Up Show.
Okay.
A radio show where they still have like unsigned rappers just spitting verses and stuff. And he was just like, my buddy was totally obsessive about collecting stuff and everything. So he just sent me a copy of that. And I was just blown away and was like, this guy's amazing. Which he is. And, you know, it was very much like the young kid at Rolling Stone going into his boss, like, this guy's going to be famous, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So
I basically did that and was like, can I write about this guy, please? Because I hadn't really I was doing small columns and stuff, but I hadn't written like a story, like a major story at all. So I did that, and my editor was very nice about it and was like, you know, slow down, son. we don't Rolling Stone doesn't really write about unsigned rappers. But if he gets signed, let me know. You know, and then lo and behold, he got signed.
Yeah.
And basically my assignment was going to be to write a short article about the My Name Is video, because that was all over MTV and was a big deal. And it was only going to be about 400 words. So that was my assignment. And then they sort of saw how many units they were shifting for the release of the record a month later. And it looked like it was going to be a big hit. So, I mean, my editor was like, you know what? Here's your shot, man. Everyone gets one shot. So you're going to go to Detroit and you're going to write a cover story. So by that time, this was a couple years later. So by that time I had written, I think I was writing Random Notes, in that same issue of the magazine. I covered the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony and had the cover story and just basically was like it was like my issue. So it was a make it or break it moment.
So what was it like when you got to Detroit and you met Marshall and you guys were hanging out? Like, I mean, how was he back then?
Well, because
this is right before it hit huge, right? Like people knew it was going to get big, but this is like pre that, correct?
Yeah, this was when My Name Is was all over the place. Like that came out, the video was out in like February. The record came out in a month later. It's just almost quaint to think about the setup that the music industry used to do. Like,
yeah.
They had a single to set up a record and, you know, only a few select people could hear it and write about it. And then, you know, it'd be on MTV and people would go to the record store on Tuesday and buy it. It's just those days are gone. So it sounds really antiquated even hearing myself say this.
Yeah.
But at that time, he was very much, I would say, the embodiment of Slim Shady.
Okay.
He was like very much just ripping tons of ecstasy and drinking and just like had absolutely nothing to lose.
Yeah.
He was, you know, he hadn't gotten his money yet from Interscope. He was still living in a trailer, and you know, when he was in New York to do the photo shoot for Rolling Stone with David LaChapelle, and at which he had never been around that many gay people before. He told me, and I don't know if I'd been, you know,
yeah.
I'm from here, so it's a little different, but you know, he did a shoot with all like David LaChapelle's studio in the East Village was like, you know, he was just like beyond fabulous, like club kids hanging out and drag queens and just incredible stuff. And, that's just kind of how it was the time. So Marshall had never seen anything like that before. So he did the shoot, you know, and then he had to do, his manager, Paul Rosenberg, had hooked up, I think, two gigs for maybe like $5,000 a piece. One was a Sweet 16 party on Staten Island. Not kidding.
Yeah. It's like My Sweet 16. You ever seen that show on MTV?
Oh yeah, My Super Sweet 16.
Yeah, I've seen a couple, like, I'm not sure it was, a couple hip hop guys have played those parties before. So I'm imagining Eminem at one of those parties in my mind now.
Yeah, well, this was definitely a seriously mobbed up situation, because it was incredible. I mean, I put all of this in the book that I eventually wrote, Whatever You Say I Am. Most of these scenes are in the article I wrote, but this backstory is not. So like we got there, and the guy, one of the father's businesses was owning this movie theater on Staten Island. And I mean, he was just like straight out of The Sopranos. And the movie theater is where this concert was being held for his daughter. So it was like, it was kind of, you know, it was a music venue, but not really. There was no dressing room. It was like we had to go up a ladder to the projector room. And it was a mob scene. Like, he was the biggest thing on. That would be like, I guess, having, I don't even know, Taylor Swift for certain people, but the kids were going nuts. And
yeah.
it wasn't really a music venue. So, you know, we had a limo sort of pulled down this alley, and these girls, like 15, 16-year-old girls, were just going bananas, and sort of there were just kids mobbed in the street. And there were cops there to kind of like help deal with it. But it was crazy. Then, you know, this like I said, this Super Sopranos guy was like, my daughter said get M&M, so I got M&M. He's like, you're gonna pose for pictures with my daughter, like just ordering him around. it was pretty amazing. It's even funnier because, you know, he and Stretch Armstrong, there's a lot of ecstasy being taken, and he'd gotten nervous during the photo shoot for Rolling Stone because he was supposed to be like pictured naked, kind of. He wasn't truly naked, but you know, and he like drank all this Bacardi and then got sick because he didn't eat anything. So he'd like drank a fifth of Bacardi, puked, taken two pills of E, and was like ready to do these shows. It was amazing. And
so he did all of that prior to performing the show.
Yeah, totally.
That's
absolutely
crazy.
It was amazing. It was that show, and then we went to two other hip-hop clubs and he did like two or three songs. And he was just, he never stopped rapping the whole night. He was just like on fire freestyling and amazing. I've never seen anything like it. But that whole scene was crazy. Everyone that was in the limo, it was about five or six of us. We basically had to stand on stage behind him And then they took us out through the back immediately because the cops were worried about these kids rioting. Wow. And it was just a madhouse. Like, these teenage girls were like putting their boobs on the windows as we're pulling away. they were very much underage. We were like, oh my God, what? It was like Beatlemania.
Yeah.
It was insane. So, but he was doing that at that point. He was still doing that because he needed the cash, you know?
Oh, yeah,
and definitely. Even though he had blown up, they didn't want to, they had signed these contracts, 6 months before, I don't know how many months before that, but he needed that extra cash at the time, which is crazy to think about now.
What led you to, you mentioned the book. So, you're doing the cover story on Eminem for Rolling Stone, and then you eventually leave Rolling Stone. You do a book with Eminem. So like, did you guys just hit it off and he liked you and wanted to work with you about that?
The book is it's a unique kind of thing because, I mean, I wrote another cover story on him. And for a while, I was the only person at Rolling Stone that he felt comfortable talking to. So I was kind of in with the camp and definitely like his dude. And then, I was a senior. I was senior staff writer there. And when these things called magazines that used to exist, yeah. when you reach a certain point, you're either going to be an editor or you're going to be a full-time writer. So I had to sort of make a decision about whether or not I was going to like spend most of my day going to meetings and pitching, giving stories out to people that I would actually rather write myself. Or handle all kinds of, just basically a little more corporate, or kind of, take a risk and write a book and hope it does well and make the rest of my career out of that. So I did the risky thing, and I had so much material from the two cover stories, and at the time, this goes to show you, or Rolling Stone didn't. Basically, at the time, they had a rule that after, I think it was, how many years? 6 years or 7 years? The original interviews, the rights of those returned to the writer, to the author of the article.
Wow.
Which would never happen now in any place because of the internet. So I basically, when I left, all of the rights to those interviews had returned to me.
So you were able to use them for whatever you wanted.
Yeah. And didn't have to pay them anything or like cut them in on my publishing deal or anything like that. Yeah. So it was a move, which I don't. I definitely, they changed the rules after that because the book was a big success and all that stuff. So, so basically, I went to M's camp and just said, "Listen, I want to write this book. I either want to like do an autobiography with you and just do it in your voice." And they basically said, "Listen, we're 8 Mile is going to come out. That's kind of enough of that. We don't need a book as well. It's like, we don't want to milk. It wouldn't really be his style to like really go for it like that."
Yeah.
But they said, "Listen, someone's going to do it and we'd rather have it be you. So you have our permission. We'll let you talk to whoever you want, clear all the interviews with us first." And I was the only journalist who he really let talk to his mom, like, wow, as much as I wanted to. I was deposed in two of his lawsuits against her. I was going to be a witness if it went to trial. Like, wow. So I was there. I was on the inside in that regard. So they trusted me with it. And kind of what came out of it was, I mean, I guess I'm biased because I wrote it, but it's a more interesting point of view than, if M's camp had controlled the narrative, because it's basically me being me as sort of an insider, writing about what I saw and his life and why it's sort of like culturally significant. It's not just a straight bio. It's like, I sort of wanted to take it more into, it's more like a college thesis on like, what does this guy mean? What is he saying? What does his popularity say about race relations in this country and like all that kind of stuff? I have a whole chapter on like the socioeconomics of Detroit and like how, the crash of the car of the auto industry sort of laid the groundwork for the poverty and stuff that helped, really affect his life. So I went off.
how did they feel about the book? Were they pretty happy with everything?
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. He said something funny to me once about it. He's just like, "I didn't know there was so much to know about me," which is funny. But yeah, no, they totally were everyone was down with it, like his publicists and Paul Rosenberg and, you know, everybody. So,
so when the book was a success, you kind of felt like you made the right choice. I mean, did you go straight into writing another book? I know you did the Tommy Lee book later on. That was more of like a co-author type thing, right?
Yeah, that was the next thing I did. I got an agent. I was like, I'm going to be a writer, not going to be an editor. And, that's pretty much what happened. I got an agent. I had an agent for the Eminem book, which was like, it was okay. And then I was sort of shopping around and I met one that was at ICM who said, I have like a major rock star who wants to do an autobiography. And, if you sign with me, like you can do it. So, and then I heard it was Tommy, and kind of everybody likes Tommy Lee somewhere. Either that or they hate him. But, I said yes to that. That was the first time I ever did a co-write, and it will definitely be an experience that I'll never forget. And, I will never do a co-write like that one again. Cause Tommy just went all in and it was really fun.
So what was the situation like? You're spending a lot of time with Tommy. Like, did you go on tour with him or anything, or did you live with him? What was the situation actually writing the stuff down, taking the notes and figuring it out with him?
Well, Tommy, he wasn't in Motley Crue at the time, and he had been engaged for 2 years, but that ended. So he was kind of like a dude when it was just not a lot to do, and he really just dove into doing the book, which was crazy. And I ended up living with him, mostly because at the time he was anti Motley Crue, and in very Tommy fashion, every time I'd ask a question about Motley Crue, he would is that a Motley Crue fan? I'm just kidding. Every time I would ask a question about Motley, he would say, "I'm not going to answer it unless you do a shot of Jack." And I was like, "Oh." This would be like 11 in the morning.
I was like,
all right, dude. So eventually, he still lived in Malibu in the house that was on MTV Cribs that he shared with Pamela Anderson for many years, which is just incredible. Like, check that episode. This place was unbelievable. And for me, it was nuts because I had always been on the other side of the fence. I was always a journalist asking questions, and artists treat you differently if, you know, you're at a magazine, especially a magazine like Rolling Stone that's respected and also at the time came out every 2 weeks. So, you know, people would be a little more careful because you could turn that into news. Like, once you're on their team and approved by their team and working for them and with them, it's a whole other animal.
Yeah.
So, you know, basically, like I said, I tried to be real professional and show up in the morning and, you know, do stuff. And eventually, you know, I didn't leave for like 5 days because I was never sober enough to drive back down the canyon. Like, his house is at the top of a like 4 mile canyon winding road, and I don't believe in driving drunk ever. So I just never left. And then eventually he's like, "Dude, why am I paying for an apartment for you? Just fucking move in. I hadn't had a roommate in years." It was great. So I didn't leave for like 8 months.
Wow. So yeah, would you guys would just survive. sit around and like drink whiskey and just like talk about his life? I mean, what is like the process for actually getting the stories together for the book?
Well, in Tommy's world, especially then, the single Tommy Lee, it would basically be like the doorbell would ring and some adventure would start that day, every awesome. Day. Like, I'd be like, "All right, man, we're going to, like, chill at your pool today." I was just like, his house was like this paradise. It was always sunny there. It was beautiful. So I'd be like, "All right, well, tomorrow we're going to cover these years." And then eventually just none of that ever happened. But we got it done. You know, we'd end up like sitting around when there weren't a series of amazing distractions, then we would kind of sit and just talk stuff over. And eventually I just made the entire book. He would, like I said, for a while there, he was very anti-Motley. So, you know, we talked about everything but that for as long as possible. So basically the whole thing became the philosophy that is Tommy's brain. until eventually I was like, he's like, "I don't want to talk about Motley. We did the Dirt. That shit's boring." And I was like, "Tommy, what? You got into Motley Crue when you were how old?" He's like, 17, bro. I'm like, "And have you ever done anything else?" He's like, "Not really." I'm like, "We have to talk about it."
Yeah.
So we eventually got there. But yeah, the book really just became,
You can't write a whole book about Methods of Mayhem, I guess. So.
No. Not at all. You know, the whole thing really became, like I said, sort of his philosophy. He's such a wonderful dude with a very charming personality. And most people that I've met him who think he's like a total bad boy, I mean, he is that stuff, but he's also a giant sweetheart. And the whole thing really became kind of what makes him tick. Everything, you know, like everything but Molly. So we talked about other music that turned him on. His philosophy about like sex and relationships and all that kind of stuff. And then we got Molly in there eventually, yeah. And it was really fun. And the whole thing became this like, God bless him. He's the kind of person who really does go in. Like he, when he sort of understood my process, when I was really in the throes of like writing the thing, he would plug like a 22-inch monitor into my laptop and would sit there chilling, and I'd like write sentences, and then he'd like read them back in his voice and like crack up, and if he liked it, I'd try to make it funnier. So I literally had somebody giving me every single way he would say a sentence, which was awesome, because the whole thing is supposed to sound just like him. And the whole thing became like kind of our adventure together, which was fun too. It was like I'm a character that I put myself in the footnotes. I usually don't like to include myself, especially in someone else's life story. But it just got so funny. Like Tommy was just the idea of putting like really academic footnotes in Tommy Lee's autobiography really stuck with me. Yeah. I was like, that's a win. If I get a publisher to approve that, that's awesome, which they loved it. And then I also, there were some things that he would just crack me up so much. Like he would just forget these details that should be kind of important to people. And I just put them in there. I would like let him say what it was and then correct him in the bottom. So the reader would see. I'd be like, it's just me, Anthony, again. He's wrong by 5 years and 2 months.
That's awesome.
And he loved it. He like wasn't insulted. He was thought it was hilarious.
So can you give me like a story that happened while you were living there that like is just an insane, like something that just sticks out in your brain?
Well, I mean, most of the stuff is in there. We put a lot of it in.
Okay.
We really did. He was like, really wanted to be honest about it, but I mean, I'll give you a short one.
Short one's good.
we, I was there for, I don't know, a couple weeks. So, I mean, the funniest thing too, is like when I got there, he wasn't around for 2 weeks and I couldn't get him on his phone. So I'm in this apartment in Santa Monica. Like I had friends in LA, so I was hanging out. But I was like, where is this guy? And eventually he just came back. He's like, oh, hey, dude, sorry. I just went to one of my friend's yacht off Mexico for 2 weeks. I'm like, okay. And I was like, you want to come over? So that's kind of how it started. But one of the greatest adventures we probably had was we went to Playboy's Midsummer Night's Dream Party, which is the one where everyone wears pajamas.
Yeah.
And Tommy had never been to the mansion as a single man.
Sounds like so, a recipe for disaster.
You can imagine what that was like. So he's like, come on, dude, we're going. And we went and he's like, but we're not wearing pajamas. So we're the only two dudes not in pajamas at this thing. And we basically we had a limo for the night. And it was just – he just filled it up with girls that came and like stayed the whole weekend. So – that was insane. That was like week three. And I like called my friends in New York and was like, you're literally not going to believe this.
That's crazy, man.
So it was just a lot of crazy shit like that. And then trying to write a book in the middle of it.
Woo. Oh yeah. You're trying to get actual work done around Tommy Lee. It's probably not the easiest thing in the world.
It was, you know, honestly, we got to a point where his manager was like, we got to see some words. And I was like, okay, I have a lot of stuff. And then I just, he was working on one of the first of his two solo records, and his guitar player, J3, who's a friend of mine now, he came out to work. So I basically sat in the studio while they did their thing, you know, with like music blasting, and just wrote right there. And it was actually the right way to do it.
That's cool. So you did a book with Slash. We talked about a little bit earlier on the show. And what I read when I was doing some research is that like Slash was like against doing a book, but he finally met with you and then he was like, oh, I like this guy. So how did that all come about?
Yeah, that is pretty much what happened. He had met with a bunch of other writers, I think seven or so over the years at various times. I mean, I didn't like, he told me later, much later, that the reason why he went with me was that I was the only person. Okay, so he had me, I came out to LA And we were supposed to meet. I was at the Roosevelt Hotel. This is pretty typical. It's pretty awesome, actually. So we were supposed to meet at like 8 o'clock. And he was like, yeah, hey, man, I just get a test drive a Ferrari in the Valley real quick. So I'm going to be a little late. And I was like, okay.
So totally normal excuse for being late, right?
Just so awesome. I'm like, yes. What color is it? So he did that, and then he didn't show up. And then he's like, hey man, you know, can you like, we're going to meet in the hotel of the Hollywood Roosevelt, or not the Hollywood Roosevelt, Sunset Towers. And anyway, so then he was like, we were going to meet and then, you know, grab some food. So I sort of went down and got a table. And then he's like, yeah, man, I got to do another errand, but can you get like a bottle of vodka and some cranberry and have it in the room? I'm like, yes. So he didn't show up until about 12:30. So, and it was fine. And showed up 12:30, and we ended up talking from then until 7:30 in the morning, which is amazing. Just looking out over the Sunset Strip, and he was just like reminiscing and all this stuff. And he later told me that in that entire, the reason why he decided to do it is because in that entire time, I didn't ask him one question about Axl Rose or Guns N' Roses.
I mean, yeah, you've got to think that that's probably all he gets asked. So, I mean you were more interested in him and his story probably, right?
Well, he started looking out over the Sunset Strip and remembered, he was talking about how he got his nickname Slash, and just like looking at places on the strip and like things from his sort of teenage years pre-Guns. And I was fascinated. I was just like, because, you know, Slash of all the guys probably had said the least in the press through the entire, you know, span of Guns N' Roses' career.
He was kind of mysterious a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. And I knew, like, you know, his mom was a costume designer, and she had done the costumes for Man Who Fell to Earth, and you know, had an affair with David Bowie, and his dad was an artist. Like, I knew just the facts about him like that, but he was just getting really into it, and it was like riveting, and I was totally fascinated about it. So that's what did it.
That's awesome, man. Yeah. So was that kind of you, that wasn't a co-write, you actually wrote the book, correct?
Well, I wrote it with him.
Oh, yeah. With him. Okay.
Yeah. It's by him with me, which basically means, you know, if it's in someone's voice, it usually, I'm going to go with 98% of the time, there's someone else writing it for someone who's famous, because usually they're busy, or
yeah,
you frankly, you should have a professional writer do it. That's what we do. Yeah. So, I mean, I wrote it all, and you know, he definitely read it and approved it, because he had said that he had read it and had a couple notes, and publisher was getting antsy because he didn't give me these notes. And eventually they just like were like, go get the notes, and like flew me to Canada when he was on tour with Velvet Revolver. And when I got there, he's like opened the first page and started right then. I was like, I called him. I'm like, I'm going to be here a couple days. Super funny. He's like, yeah, I just have a couple things. And he's like, I've gone through the whole thing. And I got there and he hadn't gone through a page, but he had some things. So we did these like marathon sessions on the tour bus. And when he wasn't doing anything for a few days there, we had to like really gun it, which was cool. It was pretty funny. It was funny though. He's hilarious.
What was it like being on the road with Velvet Revolver? This is a, you know, it's called That One Time on Tour. Most of my guests tour nonstop for a living. So even if not that time, maybe another time you were on the road with an artist or whatever, do you have any like cool things you can tell us story wise about being on the road?
I mean, I've been on the road. I've done a lot of shows with Tommy. I was on tour with Fleetwood Mac for like 3 weeks. That was amazing. That's in 2013, awesome. Writing Mick Fleetwood's book. That was a killer one because they do it first class, baby. Yeah. They were playing Jazz Fest, and it was in like, you know, the Ritz. It's like Ritz Carlton only, just beautiful food. And, you know, that was cool. I mean, I could tell you about, I just did a story. I was on tour with the Struts, band that I love.
Yeah, I love the Struts, man.
Yeah, I was on tour with them and the Foo Fighters last December. That was my most recent kind of, you know, living on the tour bus. But and that was, you know, I had my bunk and I was on tour for a week with those guys, and that was really fun. The Foo Fighters know how to throw a tour. Yeah. I would say that. The food was like amazing. The best catering food I've probably ever had. It was so good. Like all vegan options if you wanted, and everyone was really jovial and
Yeah, I had Zach from Rise Against on the podcast, and they did a big tour. They did Australia and some state shows with the Foo Fighters, and he couldn't stop talking about how great those guys were on the road.
Yeah, and they're super gracious to their opening bands. They're just like real good family, you know. Just I get, you know, when you're that successful, you can afford to tour properly.
Yeah,
but that was really fun. That was like my most probably my most recent bout on the road.
Okay, I had something that I saw on the internet that I really want to ask you about. You started to or did do a book with Courtney Love.
Yeah.
And so I guess there was some issues with that, and I think there was some litigation and whatnot. Can you kind of take me through that real quick?
I can't tell you much because of the terms of said litigation.
Okay.
But, you know, I can't, I have to be like really careful with that, to be honest. But okay. Basically, you know, what I can tell you, because these are just the facts, is that Courtney hired me to write a book, and, you know, contract, all that stuff. I wrote the book. The book exists. She had the right to not publish it if she didn't want to. That was a clause in there, which is fine. But if we had passed a certain point in the writing and the publisher approved it and wanted to publish it, then she had to pay me my, like, basically the full amount for writing.
Yeah.
And she just decided she didn't want to do that. So,
okay. Yeah,
so, and she, I think she's, you know, she's not used to people being like, oh, well, I'm going to sue you. So I sued her and I won.
What was there a lot of like hanging out with her to write the book as well, or was it all just kind of research and whatnot?
Oh no, there was a lot of hanging out with Courtney.
Oh yeah,
hours that I will never get back.
Yeah, I've got your friend Sean. Actually, your manager, Sean. Sean's a friend of mine. He was on the podcast, and we talked quite a bit about Courtney.
Yeah, well, you guys can refer to everything he said.
Okay, cool.
And make sure it wasn't for me. But yeah, no, Courtney is I don't, you know, I'm allowed to like write about her journalistically, but to get the sort of, you know, the terms of our agreement, which were very much in our favor, the one thing that we sort of settled on is that, like, you know, I'm not really supposed to talk about it.
Yeah, yeah, I get
about the process and, you know, how it came to that and all that kind of stuff. But it's a bummer because the book, I stand by the book. The book is like, it's, you know, she wanted to do her 90s rock life,
yeah,
you know, and I was much more interested in that than, like, you know, her Hollywood little moment.
yeah.
It was like a one moment. I was not as interested in that. So that's the book that we wrote, and it's really kick ass. And I feel bad for all of the 90s rock fans that will not ever get to read this unless she changes her mind, or, you know, her estate changes her mind sometimes.
Maybe she'll listen to this and she'll change her mind. Probably not, but maybe.
Probably not. I mean, I hope so. It's really, it's, you know, I will say this, the people that have read it are like, this sounds exactly like her.
Okay.
So
yeah.
So that I'm very proud of, because that is like harnessing a tornado.
Okay.
A conversational tornado. To try to get that to make sense on the page. I'm proud of being able to do that. So
well, we'll switch gears a little bit. I want to know what you've got coming out currently or what you're working on. I know that you do have a new podcast coming out. And I'd love to hear about that a little bit.
Okay. Well, writing wise, I am working on my second Eminem book, the last 15 years of his career, everything since 8 Mile, pretty much, because it's been a pretty interesting run, you know, getting sober, lots of ups and downs.
What did you think of his whole like beef with Machine Gun Kelly?
Oh, that's not a beef.
I mean, I think it's just promo, really.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, you know, it's, I just like any single person, you have to be the best, you have to be a better battle rapper than Eminem to even think about going after him.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter if you think his stuff is whack now, that guy's, his battle rapping skills are just better than anybody. He'll murder anyone.
Well,
so
I put it up against I'm a big, you know, metal guy, and when people like talk shit about Metallica, I'm like, you can't take the first four records away. I don't care what they've done since then.
Yeah, and also they'll still just like destroy you.
Yeah.
You know, they're still great. Even if you don't like a lot of their stuff, they're still amazing. So that's how I feel about anyone sort of calling it, just going for Eminem. They're just looking for publicity.
Yeah, they're just looking for people to check them out on YouTube.
Exactly. Yeah. So,
and I mean, it must have worked because Machine Gun Kelly is now in that new movie Bird Box with Sandra Bullock.
He was in Cameron Crowe's very short-lived
Roadies.
Yeah, he was in that too.
Yeah.
I watched that because I'm a giant Cameron fan. And
well, you know what's funny, when you're telling me about being on the road and you're talking to these people and you're writing these books, I keep getting the vision of Almost Famous in my head.
That you're not the first to say it. That's very much what life was like when I was at Rolling Stone and stuff like that, you know. It really was. It was. I feel a big affinity to that. I got to interview Cameron for the cover story for that movie and spent like a week with him. He's a huge inspiration to me. He gave me like quotes from my first Eminem book, like a blurb. And he doesn't really do that. He's only done that for one other book, and that's the Lester Bangs autobiography.
Wow.
Or biography rather. Which, if you've seen the movie, you know how much Lester meant to him.
Yeah.
So, Cameron is like, I adore Cameron.
That's awesome.
But yeah, but a lot of that, and that's, you know, I mean, not to sound like too much of an old guy, but a lot of that just isn't really like that anymore.
Yeah.
It's just not, and not that long ago, it still was, you know? So just like touring's different and magazines are different and digital consumption and storytelling is different. And so anyway. That movie.
So you've got the new Eminem book that you're working on. Anything else as far as like your writing?
Yeah, new M book working on now. And then I have like a couple of other things that there's no contracts yet. So Sean will yell at me if I babble about it. But
ooh, give me an exclusive. Sean will be fine. shout out to Sean. How you doing, man?
Yeah, exactly. Sean Daly, yeah. The one and only. He's got like a few different things lined up for me. This publisher that English publisher and American publisher bought the Eminem book. They might want me to do a similar sort of think piece, investigative, not really investigative, but that sounds like, you know, true crime, but like a deep dive into the significance of the career of another major rapper.
Okay. We can speculate who that is. Yeah.
You can speculate, a New York rapper.
Okay.
I'll give you that. And so that's going on. And then, I've got a couple of other things. There's a pro skater I might write a co-author a book with. And then there's also, a guy who's very huge in the dog rescue world, who has an amazing story, like a recovery story. And he's incredible. Actually, Sean's going to be working with him too. So,
cool.
Those are all in the writing realm. I got another call for a pretty big possible co-write. That with those kind of things, I never like to say too much because a lot of celebrities say they want to do it, and then their schedule changes. And you know, you got to commit enough time for me to get what I need to do my process. And some people just, you know, all of a sudden they have like a movie and all this stuff to do and they just can't do it this year. So I hesitate with that, but I have all those writing things going. And then the podcast is something I've been working on, that I'm really excited about. It's called Winyl because like wine and vinyl.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I guess I'm a big wino, but like wine is something I really adore. And I've gotten, you know, I'm pretty into the like food and wine world. Just living in New York, there's so many incredible restaurants. And I have a lot of friends that are either, you know, James Beard Award winning chefs and bartenders and just kind of people that I know. And I always end up talking to them about music because they always ask me tons of stuff about music. But so the podcast basically is I interview my subject. My subject tells me their favorite record or a record that changed their life. And I pair it with a wine that I think reflects that record in some way.
That's awesome.
And we sit down and sample the wine and talk about the wine, the record, and do a little interview.
So if I gave you a record right now, just off the cuff, could you think of a wine that would maybe pair with it well?
Let's see how well I do. Go for it.
Okay, here we go. Let's say Master of Puppets by Metallica.
Oh, boy.
The cover is red, so I'm thinking maybe a red.
Oh, well, definitely red because it's metal.
Yeah.
I would go, geez. Let's see. I would probably go with maybe like a really, I would want something kind of spicy because it's so like fast.
Okay. Yeah.
Fast,
yeah.
Fast, deep and dark. I'd go for like maybe like a Cabernet Franc, like a really good one.
Okay.
A lot of herbal notes, sort of like not really fruity. It's just more like earthy. Tastes like, you know, like old rocks. That's kind of what I would want to go for.
And we could pair it with blood sausage too.
Totally. Absolutely. Yeah, the best one is when I interview chefs, they always bring a snack. I'm like, yes.
Oh, that'd be great, man. See, yeah, most of my guests are just on Skype or FaceTime, so I don't get any cool stuff like that.
Yeah, so I've been working on that, and this music festival in Long Beach, Music Tastes Good. They're, God bless them, they let me do this live in front of an audience without even having done a podcast. That was all Sean, by the way.
Wow.
And that, it went really well. I had two chefs, two musicians, and like we talked about Prince for an hour and drank like Petite Sirah.
That's awesome, so, man.
Yeah, so it's pretty cool. It's been going well. I did, you know, I've got everyone from my friend DJ Diesel Boy, who's like a drum and bass DJ, talked about like obscure 90s shoegaze records and Dungeons and Dragons because he's a huge nerd. And then I did one with Tommy Lee, which is going to be really killer, that we talked about Physical Graffiti. And he like, talked about how much John Bonham affected his life and stuff like that. And Tom doesn't really do a lot of interviews where he talks about music, you know, it's usually He's putting something. So that was really special. I'm going to do one with Mick Fleetwood. I'm going to get, you know, it'll be the people that I've worked with who drink and a bunch of other fun people too. I went to Napa and interviewed like some winemakers and stuff. And they're like mad scientists. They're amazing. I interviewed this guy, Jeff Cohn, who's just like, he's just this kooky, amazing, like Sonoma winemaker dude. And we talked about Steely Dan and Amy Winehouse. It was just cool. So I'm having a blast with it. It's just like a really fun way for me to do interviews. Cause I sort of, I do miss that from the days of being in a magazine.
Yeah.
You know, like now when I do an interview for a book, no one's going to read that interview for like a year until I get it out, you know? So it's kind of fun to be able to just do these like little short things, and they're really fun. I've got a really good producer who's like, you know, we have sound effects and music and all that kind of stuff. So I hope people dig it.
So when does it drop?
We are starting to release our stuff January 15th.
Awesome. So this will be out a couple of days before that, hopefully. So maybe, you know, you guys go out there and check it out. It's called Vinyl, WINYL, just like vinyl with a W. And do you have what are your socials? What are ways people can find that and find stuff on you online as far as like, you know, Instagram, Facebook, stuff like that?
Okay. Well, Vinyl on Instagram is Vinylgram. And it's on Facebook, it's just like at Vinyl, I believe, or it's Vinyl Me. I should really know this. I think it's Vinyl Me, but
people know how to use socials. They'll just search for it. It'll be fine.
Yeah. If you go to my page, like I have my author page on Facebook has all that stuff, but yeah, the Instagram for Vinyl is Vinylgram, and everything will probably be linked from there. There's also going to be Vinyl Online, which will be a website, that's off of my website, which is anthonyaboza.com. And you'll find all the stuff there. Like all the episodes will be there. It'll send you to iTunes, and we're going to have it on, you know, Spotify and everything else.
Cool. Well, man, I just want to thank you so much for coming on the show today. I feel like I've heard some pretty cool stories, man. You've probably had a pretty insane life, and hopefully it continues to be just as cool, man.
Oh, thanks, bud. This is great. This is really fun.
So everybody go out there and check out the podcast Vinyl and buy one of Anthony's books. There are a lot of them out there to choose from. So just get on. They can just search for you on Amazon and all your books will come up, right?
Everything's on Amazon. Absolutely.
Awesome.
If you go to my website, you'll see every single cover story and a lot of my articles that I wrote from Rolling Stone. You can like download and read the PDFs. And then there's a page for each one of my books, a little like behind the scenes quotes from me and links to Amazon and all that stuff.
Cool.
So that's the easiest way. It's just aboza.com.
Cool. Well, man, I appreciate you so much for coming on the show. And the only thing that I ask is if Eminem ever wants to do a little tiny podcast, have him hit me up. Okay.
Jeez. Yeah, I will, dude. Absolutely.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Anthony, and good luck with the podcast and everything you've got coming up. And when the podcast comes out and it's doing well, or if you have another book come out, the Eminem book, come on back and talk about it, man, with me.
All right, will do. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks a lot, man. I'll talk to you later.
All right, bye.
Bye.
So there it was, my conversation with Anthony Boza. I had a wonderful time talking to Anthony. And everybody out there, make sure to check out his new podcast, Vinyl, just like vinyl, but with a W. It dropped Monday, I believe. This podcast is coming out in the middle of the week. So I think it's up. So go to iTunes or wherever you check out podcasts and check out Vinyl with Anthony Boza. Hopefully we'll have Anthony back in the future when his new book comes out. So check out all of his stuff. Go to Amazon. It's all there. You won't be sorry. Next week on the show, I'm super, super excited about this. I got to sit down and have a conversation with Matt Penfield. Matt Penfield is a legend. He is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He hosted 120 minutes on MTV. He did a bunch of stuff with VH1. He did the old Farm Club show. I don't even remember what station it was on, but it was really cool with all kinds of new bands. He had a radio show. He's a great guy. He's a wealth of knowledge about music, and we talked about so much cool stuff, and I can't wait for you guys to hear that, but that is next week. So make sure that you come back next week. And you can hear my conversation with Matt. I've got a lot of great guests coming up in the future. So check out the Instagram, the Facebook, the Twitter. And I'm always posting updates and letting you guys know what is going on. It's at TOTOT Podcast. But I am going to get out of here now. And we do not have any music to play this week because, you know, I'm not going to play Eminem or something. I don't want to get sued. So I'm going to get out of here. But thank you guys so much for checking everything out. Check out my sponsors, Your Button Guy, Sticker Wolf, Muncie Music Center, Rockabilia.com, and check out Punk with a Camera, the really cool guy that sponsored this episode there at the beginning. But I'm out of here. Till next week, take care of yourselves. Thank you guys so much for being a part of this journey. I love doing this podcast, and I'm so glad that you are in my life and that I am in your life. So I will talk to you guys next week. And if you're in the Midwest or anywhere where the snow is going to hit, be safe, and I'll see you next week. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Chris, this is David W. from just outside of Austin, Texas, your first patron on Patreon. I just want to tell you thank you for everything you're doing. I love it, every bit of it, even the guys I've never heard before. It's introducing me to new music, and, you know, being about the same age as you, I've been doing this for quite some time, but on the fan side, and, you know, still be discovering music is just an awesome thing. So really appreciate what you're doing.
The number you have reached is 100.7 WMMS.
It wasn't just a radio station, it was a lifestyle.
Cleveland is a rock and roll city for sure.
Get down!
The Wrath of the Buzzard. WMMS. Cleveland.
The rise and fall of one of the most iconic radio stations in America. Profiles. The Wrath of the Buzzard. PROH Files. Subscribe now wherever you get podcasts.